But anyway, one of the themes on our trip was food. Rising food prices, riots in neighboring countries. Just about every country around Ghana had riots because of food shortages. As you know, there's a worldwide shortage of rice, wheat, corn. The price keeps on going up. The next one is olive oil or cooking oil. I'm not talking about oil. There's a shortage of, the price of that is going up too. But CNN International, which was the channel we were able to watch in our different hotels as we traveled around, it comes out of London, but CNN International highlighted the growing food crisis every day we were there. And it just seemed, to me, it just hit me, what one evening we were staying in a hotel in Kumasi, which was a new hotel. It was reasonably priced, the hotel. But when we went to the dining room for dinner, we were meeting a couple of friends who were very successful Ghanaians. And we met in the restaurant, and they had a buffet. And the buffet, which was quite elaborate, very nice buffet, was 28 cedis, which is a few pennies short of $30. Just a few pennies under $30 for a buffet. And, I personally thought that, it was too expensive. By Ghanaian standards, it certainly was. But Charles, the guy that we were with and his wife, he insisted on treating us to dinner, so we had that meal. And, four of us in the restaurant had the buffet. The rest of the food, presumably, was just wasted. But what really struck me was that particular buffet at $30 is the equivalent of 1 month's wages for the average Ghanaian. It's very difficult to eat a meal when you're aware that all the people outside, in fact, including some of the waiters, perhaps, who were actually serving us, are living on $30 a month, and we're eating one meal that's costing $30. Now, that really does make you think, but it helps you realize, too, just how difficult it is for a lot of people faced with these rising food prices. And a lot of people, of course, are just not able to eat all that often anymore because they can't get the foods. Rice in particular has gone up by over 100% in the last 12 months. And rice is a staple. And some countries now have banned the export of rice because they don't have enough for their own people. And this is pushing the price up even more. Like I said, food dominated our trip. On the night to be much remembered and the last day, we took the small English language congregation in Accra, people who we've known for the best part of 30 years. They were a part of the Worldwide Church of God before United formed. We took them out for a meal. We chose a Chinese restaurant because we didn't want the complications with bread and everything else. And because it was the days of unleavened bread, I took a box of matzos to the restaurant so that each of them could have a piece of American-style unleavened bread. Some of them had asked what it was like here, and I told them it tastes like cardboard. And after they tasted it, they all agreed. I also took a jar of peanut butter from the U.S. so that they could put that on their unleavened bread so they could get a taste of that. And they have peanut butter in Ghana. In fact, Ghana grows peanuts. So it seems kind of ridiculous to take a jar of peanut butter back to Ghana. But our peanut butter is quite different, and the difference is simply one word, and that is sugar. Because our peanut butter is almost 50% sugar. Theirs has no sugar in it. So to us, it tastes kind of bland, but I think theirs probably is healthier because it doesn't have the sugar content. Anyway, everybody over dinner expressed concern about the growing food shortages, particularly rice, which, of course, we were eating at the Chinese restaurant. I pointed out what I thought was the major problem. We're actually helping three of the guys in this particular group to go through college. And I asked each of them, Ben, what are you going to be studying? Because he's about to go to University of Legon in Accra. He said, accountancy. So I asked his brother Joseph, who's older, I said, and what are you studying? He said, accountancy. So then I asked Ellen, their cousin, I said, what are you studying? He said, computers. He wants to be an IT manager or go into IT. And I said, well, do you know anybody who's studying agriculture? And they said, no. I said, well, there's the problem in Africa. Nobody wants to farm. So they have a major food shortage. Now, meanwhile, across town in Accra, you have the UNCTAD conference. That's the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development. And they had an agenda, things they wanted to discuss, but at the last minute, they changed the agenda to discuss the world food crisis. And, you know, all of them were saying we need to produce more food, but I doubt that any one of those delegates would even think about planting a garden in his backyard and trying to personally improve the world food situation. You know, there's a prejudice against farming in Africa. There's a prejudice against farming in the United States, too, because I've come across that before here. You know, people just look down on farmers generally all over the world. So it's not surprising that, you know, we've got world food shortages. So food certainly dominated things. Overeating, I think, is always a problem when going overseas. The main reason is that your routine gets severely disrupted. You know, we get on the plane here in Detroit, and they give us a meal around midnight, and then they give us another one before breakfast, actually it is breakfast, first thing in the morning. But of course, on Michigan time, they're both during the night, so it's kind of gets your body all confused. And then when you get to Ghana, you know, you have to fit in with their routine, so, you know, your body hasn't really adjusted. So it's easy to eat more than you should eat when you're traveling. So, you know, it's really important to establish boundaries, and that's what I want to talk about today, boundaries, because there are spiritual lessons for us here. One boundary that is clearly lacking in Africa, relates to hygiene. The Ghanaian health minister explained on the television news one night when we were there that 88% of all the deaths in Ghana are from waterborne diseases, and these are caused primarily by people relieving themselves in the rivers and dams. And this is what he was saying on the news. Now, imagine if our Secretary for Health, I don't even know who it is in the United States, but, you know, if he or she was on television explaining that, you know, telling the people the basic problem here is your toilet habits, and then telling them how to improve them. But he was on TV explaining that 88% of all the deaths in Ghana come back to the fact that people relieve themselves in the wrong places, in the rivers and the dams, which, of course, is the water supply. And I might also add, they relieve themselves at the side of the road. There is also no sense of privacy. We have to travel between cities, and it's a five-hour drive. If we have to go, we have to go at the side of the road, like everybody else. So when that happens, I'll tell the taxi driver, okay, stop right here. I wait until we're going along a part of the road where there's rainforest on both sides. So you can easily go in the forest, and as long as no snakes bother you, you know, you just go in the forest and do what you have to do. But the taxi drivers, who are all Ghanaians, they wait. They don't stop out in the rainforest. They wait until they reach a village with lots of people, then they stop. Because in Ghana, there's no sense of privacy. So there's no concept of boundaries when it comes to these things. And, of course, it's a culture clash. But boundaries are a problem constantly when you travel, and especially in West Africa, not just in food and not just in personal hygiene, but I think also in our society in the Western world, we have a problem with boundaries. God gives us boundaries, but I think today we like to blur those boundaries. We don't attach much importance to them. Let's take prayer and Bible study, for example. Again, with these, it's best to have a routine, to have boundaries, to put aside time for prayer and Bible study for our personal relationship with God. But it's difficult to maintain a routine when traveling. If your routine is to pray and study in the morning, which mine is, the difficulty when traveling is determining exactly when morning is. In Ghana, mornings are the middle of the night in Michigan. I've been trying to teach the Ghanaians this for years, but they still get it wrong. We still get calls in the middle of the night because they don't realize the time difference. And sometimes it happens when we come back too. We get people calling late at night the first day we're back. when, of course, it's the middle of the night in Ghana and we're kind of zonked at about 9 o'clock at night. So it's difficult for people to understand these things. But in Ghana in the mornings, because of the time difference, it really isn't the best time to study or to do anything else for that matter. I'm sure God understands, which is probably why he did not give us the ability to fly. We're not supposed to travel halfway around the world in 24 hours. It's just not good for us. So we have to adapt our routine on every trip. Going to Australia in July will be even more challenging, as there's a 14-hour time difference with the east coast of Australia. That means when I leave Lansing at 3 p.m., it's already 5 a.m. next day in Brisbane. Even more challenging is the fact that when I leave on a Tuesday afternoon and arrive there Thursday morning, Wednesday just disappears. There is no Wednesday, which is very confusing because we cross the international date line. So when you cross the international date line going west, it's still Tuesday here, but, you know, it's starting to be Thursday there. So, you know, it gets very, very confusing. When we come back, it's even more challenging because I leave Tasmania at 6 a.m. in the morning, which is 4 p.m. the previous day here, and I arrive back at 11 p.m. The same day. So I leave at 6 a.m., arrive back at 11 p.m., which in theory is 17 days of traveling, but you've got to add the 14 for the time difference, so it's 31 hours of traveling, and it's the same day, all the same day, all that time. You know, so when I get back, if you see me the next day, please understand if I don't know where I am or I fail to recognize you or make any sense. I know that happens sometimes anyway, but, you know. But you know what you could do? I mean, if you were this way inclined, you could leave Lansing on a Friday afternoon and fly to Australia, and you'd actually miss the Sabbath. The temptation is to do that over atonement. And you could miss atonement altogether. You see? You could leave here just before atonement, fly there, and you wouldn't have to keep atonement at all. But I try never to fly on the Sabbath. I deliberately try not to, because I don't think it's the best thing to do on the Sabbath. But somebody told me that their flight to Australia for the feast got delayed. And so they ended up keeping atonement for like 35 or 36 hours or something. And you know, it wasn't their fault. They didn't plan it that way, but it happened. So, you know, these things can happen when you're messing around with different time zones. But, you know, I know sometimes as well that different churches have even messed around with these things. For example, in Fiji, which is the first country on the other side of the international date line, Fiji is a strong Methodist country, and the government you know, operates around Methodist teachings. So Sunday is their day of rest. But when the Seventh-day Adventists found that their members there could not work because everybody had to work on Saturdays, the Seventh-day Adventists decided that the dateline should actually be the other side of Fiji. Therefore, Saturday in Fiji was really, oh no, Sunday was really Saturday or something. And therefore, their members actually keep the Sabbath on Sunday in Fiji because it's so close to the dateline. It's kind of weird, and to me, it smacks of compromise, but, you know, that is what they did. So you can play around with these things if you have a devious nature. And perhaps, again, this is why God sets boundaries, to help us to remember his laws. And when it comes to the Sabbath, you look at Genesis chapter 1, for example, he clearly sets boundaries. He's very specific as to exactly when the Sabbath is, as the title of one of our booklets is, from sunset to sunset is the Sabbath. And that's very specific. So wherever you are in the world, it's fairly easy to understand, unless you are above the Arctic Circle, when there is no sunset during the summer. So then you've got a problem. I stayed above the Atlantic Circle once, and just for the experience, and it was in August, and, you know, it was still light at 4 a.m., and I finally got to sleep, and when I woke up at 6, it was light again. I'd missed the darkness, and in August, it was only like half an hour or something. But if you're there on Midsummer's Day, there's absolutely no darkness at all, not even a minute. Of course, the reverse is that if you're there on midwinter's day, there's no light at all. So you're in darkness all the time, which must be very depressing living up there. The thing to do is to live up there in the summer and then move to Australia for the winter. But if you can do it. Anyway, look at Genesis chapter 1. Beginning in verse 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Then God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw the light that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. So the evening and the morning were the first day. The day begins at sunset, the biblical day, the day in the Hebrew calendar begins at sunset and ends at sunset. And it, you know, it's very specific. The evening and the morning were the first day. And you see that repeated, that terminology repeated in verse 8. So the evening and the morning were the second day. And then you see repeated again in verse 13. The evening and the morning were the third day. And verse 19, you see it again. The evening and the morning were the fourth day. So through repetition, he's teaching us something which is specific regarding the Sabbath. Verse 23, so the evening and the morning were the fifth day. And verse 31, so the evening and the morning were the sixth day. And then in chapter 2, it says, on the seventh day, God ended his work which he had done in verse 2, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. And the seventh day, like the other days, began at sunset, the evening and the morning. The evening, the darkness, followed by the daylight, which is the day. So again, it's very specific, and God establishes the boundary. There's a boundary there when it comes to the Sabbath, and we have to take the boundary seriously. Exodus 20 and verse 8, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath day of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, you nor your son nor your daughter nor your male servant nor your female servant nor your cattle nor your stranger who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Again, the boundary is set there, not only for ourselves, but even for people within our household and also animals within our household. And this is something that's a constant challenge in Africa, because certainly the wealthier people, and not even very wealthy at that, people say earning $400 a month or more, which would be the wealthiest people in Ghana, would all have servants, at least a servant, and it's almost inconceivable to anybody that you give the servant a day off. But, you know, we go through these scriptures and help them to see that on the seventh day, their servant should also get the day off. And they should take care of themselves and not rely on somebody else to cook for them. But, you know, it's a very hierarchical society, and they expect those things to be done for them, even on the Sabbath. So it's quite a challenge sometime, trying to explain some of these things. Look at Psalm 55. Psalm 55. Sometimes I think it's good for us to also set our own boundaries. Where David writes here in Psalm 55 and verse 17, evening and morning and at noon I will pray and cry aloud, and he shall hear my voice. So evening, morning, and at noon. Now I don't know what David's routine was as far as eating goes. Because, you know, 3 meals a day was the norm when I was growing up. I think now that's changed, and one of the fast food places was even advertising something as the fourth meal of the day. And a lot of people eat a number of times throughout the day, a little bit. I mean, one of the diet books says every 3 hours or something, you nibble an apple or something, or a couple of bits of lettuce or something like that every 3 hours. So, you know, people eat differently to the way they used to. But when I was growing up, it was 3 meals a day. And I think that was the norm through, say, the early part of the 20th century. And maybe David was eating 3 times a day. And at those particular times also, you know, he made sure that he prayed and had that personal relationship with God. And I don't just mean asking the blessing on the meal. But the point is, we need something to help us to remember to do certain things. Just like in Exodus 20, verse 8, it says, remember the Sabbath day. Because it is easy to forget the boundary. You can easily miss the boundary. We missed the boundary last Saturday night. You know, I booked my flight to leave Ghana on Saturday night at 9:20. And sunset in Ghana is 6 p.m. And so I asked the airport transit van at our hotel, I asked the driver to take us at 6. Well, he came to us at 4:30 and said, I must take you at 5. He said, the airline wants everybody there early. And it was one of those last-minute things. And, okay, well, you know, we were all packed. So I said, okay, well, we'll go at 5. So we went at 5. And, you know, we had arranged to see one of the sons of one of our church members who has been compromising with the Sabbath. You know, every kid, I believe, has to work these things out themselves. And I was advising the parents. I said, you know, you've just got to leave him, let him sort it out himself. And anyway, so he was going to meet us at the airport. He worked at a small store there that sold a few things, souvenirs and things. And he was going to meet us at the store at 6, just after 6 p.m. Because we were going to check in at 6, and I told him, we'll be in your store at about 6:30. Well, you know, we got disoriented, not for the first time. You know, we had to get to the airport early, and they rushed us through. So we were checked in within 15 minutes. So at 5:45, I think it was, we saw this guy, and we went over to him, said hello, and we bought a couple of things. And I realized afterwards, it didn't hit me for a few hours, I realized afterwards, oh, we really goofed. First of all, we bought a couple of items on the Sabbath, unnecessarily, which I don't like doing. But secondly, we'd set a bad example to him. He's already got a Sabbath problem, he's compromising, and we'd arrive before sunset. Wasn't deliberate, but you see why God says, remember the Sabbath day? It is so easy to forget these boundaries. There's a boundary when it comes to the Sabbath. The Sabbath begins at a certain time, it ends at a certain time, and it should be kept. And it should be kept in the way God wants us to keep it. And it's not a time for going to buy souvenirs, for example, to bring back to people in Ghana. You know, my granddaughter had asked us to bring back a giraffe. I wasn't sure whether she meant a real giraffe or a stuffed animal or something. So that's what we were looking for. You know, here we were at the last minute leaving Ghana, and we still hadn't got this giraffe. And if you're a grandparent, you know you cannot go back to your grandparents, grandchildren, if you haven't bought whatever it is they wanted. So I thought, I've got to find a giraffe. So that's why we'd gone to that store. And, you know, but afterwards I thought, you know, really, we didn't set a very good example with this young man who's still working his own particular Sabbath situation out. But it's too late. We'd already gone through the airport security and everything. I couldn't go back and try to put things right. And, you know, but just one of those things. I completely forgot. And it's easy to forget, which is why God says, remember the Sabbath day. And, you know, we have to apply boundaries. And those boundaries are important. And it's too easy sometimes. When you cross the boundary, it's easier to go over the boundary again and again and again until before you know it, you're doing all your shopping at Myers on a Saturday morning, which, of course, would be inappropriate on the Sabbath. In fact, it would actually be a sin on the Sabbath to do that. Now, you know, the boundaries apply when it comes to the Sabbath, when it comes to the holy days. Boundaries apply in other areas as well. Look at the subject of morality, for example. There are so many specific instructions, all intended to keep you out of trouble, to make your life happier without falling into pitfalls, because not everything is clear. Now, some things are clear to us. I mean, to use an example here, you know, it is clear that there are certain things we shouldn't eat. This time of the year in Ghana is mushroom season. And they hold up at the side of the road these huge mushrooms for sale. I mean, they're quite big. And, you know, when we lived there, Diane would often buy the mushrooms and use them in soups. And the people who were selling these mushrooms obviously clearly understood the difference between the poisonous mushrooms and the ones that we could eat. Because we never had a problem with any of the mushrooms that we bought. But Ghana also does have poisonous mushrooms. And if you don't know what you're looking for, you could easily get the wrong kind if you go out into the rainforest and start picking mushrooms. But the people selling them at the side of the road, they always seem to have the good ones, and that's fine. So you'll notice in the scriptures that it doesn't list all the plants and the fungi and so on that we shouldn't eat. But it does tell us which animals we shouldn't eat, because we wouldn't be able to discover that ourselves, not immediately anyway. And so, for example, grass cutters, which I mentioned before in Ghana, which are just huge sewer rats, they hold up at the side of the road for sale, the same as they hold up the mushrooms. And, you know, you can buy one of these if you're that way inclined. It came up in discussion at our lunch last week on the last day of Unleavened Bread. And I asked people what they taste like, because they all tasted them before they came in the church. And they were telling me that they taste like chicken. Why is it everything that's unclean tastes like chicken? It makes you wonder sometimes, especially at a Chinese restaurant, if you're really getting chicken. Reminds me of a cartoon I saw in the Lansing State Journal. A couple of people approaching a Chinese restaurant, and a sign in the window, a great big sign saying, "No, we have not seen your cat." because apparently cats also taste like chickens, but I don't know. Anyway, God does specifically tell us which animals we shouldn't eat, knowing that those animals are not good for us. And, you know, people in the West, back when our former association changed its understanding on this, a lot of people thought, oh, this is great. I can now eat pork, I can eat lobster, etc. But, I pointed out at the time to the people in Pasadena, I said, the change in that doctrine means that in Africa, people are going to eat animals that can kill them very quickly. Because they're unclean, like rats, for example. Monkeys, snakes, and so on. Some of them have, poisons in them which can be fatal. And I believe that even the ones over here, for example, that we're told not to eat, do our bodies harm long term. Maybe not in the short term like they do in Africa. So anyway, again, there's boundaries. God gives us boundaries when it comes to what we should eat and what we should not eat. And he gives us boundaries in the moral area. What looks good may not be good for you. Adultery, for example, may look good, may even feel good, but it's definitely not good for you. And the same with fornication. Less obvious, perhaps, is what I will call, for the sake of family members here, adult reading material. Not that there's much reading involved. It's more the pictorial displays that people are interested in, if you follow my drift. But look at Leviticus chapter 18, because again, the specific guidelines, in fact, they're not guidelines, these are boundaries that God gives us. They're not guidelines, and we need to apply them in our own lives. And this is one of the major problems of our age. And if you don't have a problem personally with this, you may feel that nobody else does, but I can assure you a lot of people do. A Christianity Today magazine, which is for conservatives, conservative mainstream Christians, when it polled its readership, found 27% had a major problem with, adult publications or adult material on the internet, pornography. That figure probably is a lot higher now, because this was a few years ago. But when you look at some of these specific instructions in the scriptures, you see that, it's not good for us to see these things, and we should be very strict with ourselves. We need to establish boundaries. As I said to one person recently, if you can't handle this, then get rid of the computer. The response was, well, I need the computer. I mean, you've got to have the computer just to write to people, etc. I said, look, man managed to survive for 6,000 years without computers. How can anybody say they have to have a computer? If it's a problem for you, if it causes you to go down an ungodly path, and you have an addiction problem, and some people have an addiction problem when it just with the computer in the general sense. They're addicted to it. They have to be on the computer so much. They're not doing anything wrong on the computer. They may only be sending messages and checking the news, etc. But still, the computer can become a god. It can become a form of idolatry. But then, of course, some people get into the adult websites. And then, of course, those are very addictive for many people. And, you know, many people in the church have shared that problem with me. So this particular passage of Scripture, I think, is, you know, very pertinent to us today. And it says in verse 1, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, I am the Lord your God. According to the doings of the land of Egypt where you dwelt, you shall not do. And according to the doings of the land of Canaan where I am bringing you, you shall not do. Nor shall you walk in their ordinances." So right at the beginning he says, don't follow the practices of some of these other nations. And, you know, some of their practices involve, for example, polygamy. Or just in the general sense, all polygamy is really. It's just multiple relationships with lots of different people. Polygamy just dresses it up in a nice fancy name. But that's all it is. It's just, you know, a guy can't be loyal and faithful to the one woman, so he, you know, has quite a few women there. And, you know, just, by the way, just to digress for a moment, I've got to say this. You know, this thing down in Texas with the polygamous compound or whatever, you know, much as I abhor the whole practice, why are they zeroing in on a Mormon group when polygamy is very common amongst Muslims, including Muslims in the United States? And I got a friend who worked with refugees, bringing refugees into America, and he was telling me of how the State Department accommodates polygamous relationships. You know, they'll take the man and his first wife, come in on a family visa to America. This happened in Lansing. He was telling me about Lansing. A man came in with his first wife, and I think it was 6 children. They got one visa. And then his second wife came in as a single mother with her 5 children. And the third wife came in as a single mother with her 7 children. And they were given 3 apartments in the Lansing area, 3 families. But, of course, the man was able to go to the different apartments. So, you know, de facto, we're allowing polygamy and encouraging polygamy. But you see, they're Muslims. That's okay. That's a part of their culture. But we can't handle it when it's white people down in Texas. Now, of course, they're all wrong. You know, it's wrong no matter which group you're looking at. But why don't they do something about the Muslims? But that's not PC. They're not going to do that. Anyway, so God is saying, don't be influenced by these alien customs. You shall observe my judgments and keep my ordinances to walk in them. I am the Lord your God. You shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, which if a man does, he shall live by them. So again, these are boundaries we have to abide by, and we have to incorporate them into our own lives. None of you shall approach anyone who is near of kin to him to uncover his nakedness. I am the Lord. So when it comes to family members of the opposite sex, is what it's saying, then we must follow these rules of privacy. And this is repeated a number of times, very specific. God gets very specific because people will look for loopholes. People are always looking for loopholes in the law. And again, this comes up all the time, but what if in certain circumstances? What about this? What about that? You know, like children. Children, will do that with you as well. The nakedness of your father or the nakedness of your mother you shall not uncover. She is your mother. You shall not uncover her nakedness. You know, God knew that that was just the start. It could lead to other things. So you stop it before it starts. And this principle applies to pornography as well. Don't look, or it will lead to other things. The nakedness of your father's wife you shall not uncover. It is your father's nakedness. The nakedness of your sister, the daughter of your father, or the daughter of your mother, whether born at home or elsewhere, their nakedness you shall not uncover. So very specific, very detailed, establishing boundaries, which have been passed down in Israelite culture, which I find very interesting, because these are not boundaries in other cultures. They are to a certain extent now because of westernization. But in traditional African culture, these were not boundaries, for example. The nakedness of your son's daughter or your daughter's daughter, their nakedness you shall not uncover, for theirs is your own nakedness. The nakedness of your father's wife's daughter, begotten by your father, she is your sister. You shall not uncover her nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's sister. She is near of kin to your father. Now, why do we have all these specific rules and regulations? Because when you see the nakedness of a member of the opposite sex, it's going to lead to desires, which are inappropriate, and feelings, which at some point people are going to act out on. And it's exactly the same with pornography, which is why we've got to stay away from it. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's sister. She is near of kin to your father. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your mother's sister, for she is near of kin to your mother. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's brother. You shall not approach his wife. She is your aunt. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your daughter-in-law. She is your son's wife. You shall not uncover her nakedness. And so it goes on. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your brother's wife. It is your brother's nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of a woman and her daughter. Nor shall you take her son's daughter or her daughter's daughter to uncover her nakedness. So stepchildren, in other words, they are near of kin to her. It is wickedness. Nor shall you take a woman as a rival to her sister to uncover her nakedness while the other is alive. So, you know, very specific family members there mentioned, so that there was no excuse. Also, you shall not approach a woman to uncover her nakedness as long as she is in her customary impurity. Moreover, you shall not lie carnally with your neighbor's wife to defile yourself with her. So it goes on like that. You know, many years ago I saw a documentary on the History International Channel, which I quoted in an article I wrote for the Good News. And they profiled the people in Denmark in 1967. Denmark was the first country to legalize pornography. And the Danish Parliament's reasoning was that if we allow pornography, then men will no longer molest women or assault women. If we legalize pornography, it will stop these things from happening. Well, almost 40 years later, they got these people back together, the ones who were still alive, and asked them how they felt now about the change in the law. When Denmark changed the law, every Western country eventually followed. And they all regretted the decision they made in 1967, because the reverse has been the case, that it's actually increased sexual crimes against women. And it all comes back to pornography, and they agreed with that. It actually makes things worse, not better. So I think God knew what he was doing when he gave us all these rules and regulations. And so, you know, everything, pornography, strip clubs, you know, whatever your thing is, you know, they're a sin. Look at 1 Corinthians 6, verse 18. He has another clear boundary which is established. Flee fornication, or flee sexual immorality, it says. Every sin that a man does is outside the body, but he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body. Fleeing sexual immorality, looking at pornography is exactly the opposite of fleeing sexual immorality. You're told to flee from it, therefore you don't get into those websites or buy those magazines or watch those movies, or go to Deja Vu or whatever other place that you may go to. And note, you actually do harm to your own body. This is a clear, specific command. Here's another one which today I think most people would ridicule in our society, but it's still a boundary, and it's one that, if followed, would stop a lot of things from happening. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 22. Says, abstain from every form of evil. Avoid even the appearance of evil. And, interpreting that means a man and woman should not even be alone unless they're married to each other. And, of course, that was a norm followed in our society until fairly recently. It's only really with birth control and the fact that there's no longer a fear of pregnancy that these rules and regulations have been relaxed. But you go back 100 years and, you know, you had to have a chaperone. A man and woman could not be alone, not until they got married. Because when they're alone, things can happen. So you avoid the appearance of evil by not being alone. And, you know, we have a requirement in the church that, you know, a minister visiting a lady should have somebody else with him to avoid any suggestion of impropriety or any accusations that might come. Let's look at another area where we have to set boundaries, because there are boundaries that need to be set in so many different aspects of life. Another area is money, when it comes to money. And again, we've gotten away from boundaries in our society today. Look up the word debt or debtor, or related words in a concordance. There's just a handful of verses with the word debt or debtor in those words. But in all cases, when applied to money, it's a bad thing. But our society encourages debt and tries to suck us all into greater debt. A European finance minister recently said that the primary cause of the international credit crunch is overspending by the U.S. federal government. Yet it keeps on increasing. Not one of the candidates running for office this year has addressed it. All are making promises that will actually increase it. I've been interested to note the Wall Street Journal has been consistently against all the recent interest rate cuts by the Federal Reserve, because all it's doing is increasing the amount of money in circulation, which is pushing up the prices of everything, not just in the U.S. but around the world, principally oil, but also food. So as the Wall Street Journal points out, it basically comes down to the fact that we cannot live within our means. We don't know how to. We don't have boundaries when it comes to money, nationally or even in most cases, or many cases anyway, individually. People just keep on overspending. And, you know, that is the basic cause of the problem. It was disclosed this week that the federal deficit this year will be $330 billion. It was also announced that another $770 million will be given to African countries to help them cope with the food crisis, which is caused primarily by our overspending. Clearly, there's no boundary, and not even a concept of a boundary. Again, in the area of money, God is very specific. He gives us boundaries. You look at Malachi chapter 3, for example, where he talks about the importance of tithing for a nation, of giving God what belongs to God. And verse 8, it says, "Will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me. But you say, in what way have we robbed you? In tithes and offerings. You are cursed with a curse, for you robbed me, even this whole nation. Bring all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house. And try me now in this, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such blessing that there will not be room enough to receive it." So a tithe is a specific amount. Again, there's a boundary, 10%. You see, it's specific. And he's saying here that the country needs to, you know, to practice this particular biblical principle. Matthew 23 and verse 23. I think a side benefit is that tithing helps you budget. It helps you to be more responsible with your money. But it struck me, too, in looking at Malachi chapter 3, how it says about the storehouse in Malachi chapter 3. Here we are faced with international food shortages. And even in this country, we don't have enough food now to feed ourselves. We import food from the European Union because we don't have enough for America, which is the first time in our history that we've had a problem with food. But it says, bring all the tithes into the storehouse. And he says, if I will not open you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such blessing that there will not be room enough to receive it. You know, we're not being blessed the way we were being blessed. And a lot of that has to do with breaking God's laws. Matthew 23 and verse 23. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. So, you know, this confirms still that this biblical principle of tithing and of living within our incomes is very much still in effect. And, you know, you think, too, the teachings about reserves. You remember the story of Joseph in Egypt and how Joseph built up the food reserves. We don't have those food reserves anymore. So, you know, I suspect at some point we are going to have some serious food problems, as, you know, some of the world now is experiencing that. Finally, another area is stress. I remind you of the definition of stress, that stress is the difference between expectations and reality. But one of the primary causes of stress is, again, that we don't have boundaries. We don't establish boundaries like we should. You know, I think about stress a great deal whenever I'm in Ghana or on my way home because, as I've said many times before, they're not stressed out like we are. And why is the question? Well, there's no simple answer. But believe it or not, I think one reason why they're not as stressed out is because they have no labor-saving devices. No cars, no vacuum cleaners, no microwave ovens, no washing machines, no maintenance. And, you know, without a car, you can't just run off somewhere. You can't go somewhere. You're restricted. So, you know, their lives are much more simple. So they don't have a lot of the stresses that we have. But, you know, I think there's other factors, too. I think we have a lot of stress because, again, we don't establish the boundaries that we should have. I mean, for example, the Sabbath. If we really did take note of the boundaries and stopped whatever we're doing at sunset and then, you know, had that 24-hour break from whatever we do, then, of course, we benefit from that. We relax, we rest. Which is, you know, what the word Shabbat means. It's rest. We rest. We cease from our labors. It's cessation from labor, I think, is literally what it means. But it's too easy, especially in this age of the internet, it's too easy to have work intrude into our lives, the internet and the cell phone. And a lot of people are addicted to both. You know, I find that a lot, you know, and I mean, I have my own problems there too, I guess, because, you know, I usually take my cell phone with me anywhere, but if anybody calls, you know, I look and see who it is. Maybe I should just get rid of it completely. I don't know. That'd be hard to do. But, you know, we have to be very, very careful to establish boundaries and make sure that, you know, we're not, you know, we're not letting these things intrude into the time that we should have for other things. Not just the time we should have with God, but also the time that we should have with other people, with, you know, people, for example. Look at Matthew chapter 6 and verse 34. It says, "Do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about its own things. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble." You know, go back a bit to verse 24. "No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon," money. "Therefore I say to you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on. Is not life more than food and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air, for they neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns. Yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they? Which of you by worrying can add one cubit to his stature?" So, you know, this is a passage just telling us not to worry about things, which, of course, contributes to a general sense of stress. Even if we don't worry about financial things, we might worry about other things. This has to get done. We've got to do this. We've got to do that. We don't have to do all of those things. And I think sometimes one thing that helps is just try to imagine what it will be like when you're dead. Not for you, because you won't know anything. But the point is, everything will still get done. Everybody will still cope. So, you know, why get so stressed out about all the different things you have to do? "Which of you by worrying can add one cubit to his stature? So why do you worry about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. And yet I say to you that even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. Now, if God so clothes the grass of the field, which today is and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? Therefore, do not worry, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? For after all these things the Gentiles seek. For your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about its own things. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble. I was impressed by a couple of things this week. Somebody called me soon after I came back and said that they might be losing their house because of financial difficulties. And yet the person who called was very positive and very confident that things would work out, and not sure exactly how they would work out, but they were very confident about it. And then a couple of days later, on Thursday, my son called. His company ceased business, ceased trading at 12 noon on Thursday, just went out of business. So he's out of a job, got a wife and two children. He worked for a company called Enhanced Wireless, which had an exclusive contract with Sprint. And Sprint, the cell phone company, has also been having difficulties. But Enhanced Wireless was the unit of Sprint that basically did business in all of the malls across America, and he managed the outlet in the Lansing Mall. And Thursday they just went out of business. And so he's unemployed. And, you know, I talked to him on the phone. As soon as I heard the news, I gave him a call. And again, he was still very positive that things would work out, that everything would be all right. So, you know, I'm pleased to hear that, you know, that you know, we have to look to God and through difficult times and ask him for help, and then not worry unduly, as it says here in this particular passage. We've got to do what we can do for ourselves, but not worry unduly. You know, we live in a crazy economic system where an illiterate guy who plays football well can make more money than the hardest working person in the land. Doesn't make any sense. Or where somebody who looks good can make a fortune by going to Hollywood, even though they may not have an IQ in the double figures. Then you've got irresponsible corporate CEOs who walk away with millions while their company falls apart and thousands lose their jobs. It's a crazy economic system. And some people end up on the bottom, and, you know, it's not their own faults when that happens. I mean, sometimes it is, but often it's not, because our system doesn't make any sense. Now, you know, Revelation 18 shows that the final economic system will be Euro-centered. But what we have now is not dissimilar. Our system is leading to the European-centered financial system. And the system is rightly called in the scriptures Babylon. And Babylon means confusion. Tower of Babel is what it goes back to, confusion. You know, when you think about it, what is the most important job in this country? Or the most important job in Ghana? There's one job we cannot live without, and that's farming. And yet, universally, people look down on farmers. So where's the sense in it? You know, and we don't have anybody farming here, but, you know, we're heading towards this food problem throughout the world. You look at ancient Israel, when God led the people out of Egypt, and all of the tribes, except for the Levites, were given land to farm. So it was an agriculturally based society, and that's the way it was for centuries, right up until recent times. But, you know, we have to be careful not to let these things worry us unduly. But to get back to boundaries, closeness to God helps us cope with stress, but so does setting boundaries. We have to set aside time for God, for true Sabbath observance, for our relationships with other people. But we also need to limit the time that we spend on some other things. I know this is a problem for a lot of people, because a lot of people have shared this with me. They spend too much time on the internet. They spend too much time watching TV. Or they spend too much time doing something else, which takes away from the important things. So why not try limiting the time? For example, why not just check your email twice a day, morning and at night, and limit yourself to, say, 20 minutes each time, or 30 minutes, or even an hour? But don't keep on checking it throughout the day, because that stops you then from doing the things which you should be doing, the things which are needed the most. You know, and then why not just set specific times to eat so you don't eat too much? You know, Diane's grandmother, when we used to stay with her in Detroit, used to drive me crazy. She had to eat at breakfast was 8 o'clock every day without fail. Lunch was always 11:30. Dinner was always 4 o'clock. Rigid, absolutely rigid, three times a day. She lived to be 98. Maybe it's because she had a rigid routine that she lived so long. And, you know, I grew up in a family where we ate three times a day. It wasn't quite as rigid, but we ate three meals a day. But now it's possible, if you're meeting people all over the place, to eat six or even 10 meals a day. You know, always eating something. That's not good for you. So again, we need to set limits there. What about the phone? You know, we can set a limit with the phone. If you've got caller ID, you don't have to answer every phone call. You can just wait and maybe make all your calls a couple of times a day. And what about TV, you know? Just limit yourself to maybe 1 hour a day or whatever. I mean, it's up to you. You've got to work that out yourself. But the average person apparently spends like 4 hours and 45 minutes or something watching television each day, the average. So it's kind of hard to believe, but again, we have to establish boundaries. That's what it comes back to. We're a society that has lost the concept of boundaries, but we have to establish boundaries to reduce the stress. Stress, again, is the difference between expectations and reality. You know, our expectations are too great. There's so many things we want to do, and we just don't have the time. So the reality is we don't have the time, and therefore we get stressed out. And that affects relationships really badly. People take it out on each other. Even my wife occasionally gets upset with me. I'm just being humorous here. I'm sure everybody's wife gets upset with them occasionally, and everybody's husband does. And some of that is just due to stress. And that is due to not setting boundaries. And so things get out of control, and then we get upset with each other. So clearly boundaries are important, whether it be in our daily personal relationship with God, our observance of the Sabbath and the holy days, or in our personal relationships with other people. With money or with time, we need boundaries right across the personal spectrum of life. Being careless with boundaries is only going to make life more stressful. We can avoid a great deal of stress by taking note of the boundaries that God has set in our lives.